This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Singing for our lives, we are gentle, angry people, and we are singing for our lives.
Good morning, this is Denise Morris. I'm joined this morning by Yasmin Nair. We're going to talk a little bit about the recent coming out of Jason Collins. Yasmin Nair, welcome to KBOO. Oh,
thank you. It's a pleasure always to be back. Thank you.
Yes, you are a regular with us on the Old Mole, and it is great to have you back. Let me remind folks who you are. You are an activist in Chicago. You're a writer. You're involved in many organizing activities. You are also the co-founder of the online archive Against Equality, and your writing includes critical essays, book reviews, investigative journalism, exploring issues around queer politics and theory, immigration, prisons and hate crimes legislation, neoliberalism, and inequality. And I think much of that might come up in our conversation this morning. Yasmin, we are going to attempt to make something out of this coming out of Jason Collins. The recent coming out of this NBA basketball player has generated really an enormous buzz. And last week he became the first active male professional athlete to come out of the closet. And he did this with a cover story for Sports Illustrated. The story itself is in Jason Collins' own words, and some have compared him to Jackie Robinson, although many have noted that Robinson came up in a much different political climate, really 8 years before the modern civil rights movement would emerge. And this morning we'd like to try to scratch the surface of this event in order to examine some of the more deeply held assumptions about the social power of coming out, the drive for equality, and argue for the need to build a more vibrant, imaginative queer left politics. And Yasmin, since you are technically a member of the media, I wanted to have you talk about your initial reaction to hearing about Collins coming out.
You know, I read his statement, and I should confess, first of all, as someone who's not a sports fan, my initial response was indifference, but although I was interested in the coming out issue. And I started to look at his statement, and I started to look at the responses to that. And as someone who's not a sports fan of any sort, I should add that this knowledge of mine comes entirely from what I'm reading. And in fact, he's not really... And this is related to, I think, how this whole coming out has played out. He's not actually the first player in major sports to be out. My understanding is that Glenn Burke, who played for the Los Angeles Dodgers from 76 to 79, actually, was out. And in fact, he even released an autobiography, I think, towards the end of his life. He actually... was very much more out, perhaps, than a great many other sports figures since then have been. But I think what's fascinating is that no one paid attention to Glenn Burke at the time. And again, sports fans out there can correct me, of course. But I think that what I find interesting about Collins' coming out is how, on the one hand, I'm not saying it's not genuine. It's, of course, very genuine, and it was a rather, you know, it was an interesting and beautifully written statement as well, where he references his twin brother, his family, his gay uncle. But it's also very well modulated, and it's very, you know, he's a perfect poster child for coming out. There's nothing uncomfortable about his narrative. And I think if we could today perhaps talk a little bit about what coming out has come to mean is actually in a way that you can only come out in a very particular way, and this is a particular kind of person. You know, it took a long time for people to even acknowledge Martina in tennis, a long time to acknowledge other perhaps more discomforting people, and I'm sort of fascinated with that.
Yeah, I think we're both on the same page. You know, I have been thinking all through preparations that, you know, what we have to have are exceptional heroes. And if Jason Collins had come out as someone other than this upstanding citizen, let's say someone who liked anonymous sex in parks or opposed U.S. imperialism, a no-no for any sports. I mean, we could talk a lot about, you know, athletes coming out against war, against racism. You know, they become skewered. It's very much a no-no. What if he were an atheist or hated kids? You know, I mean,
Even if he were not, I think what's fascinating about, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
What I find fascinating, just in terms of what you were saying about, right, if he had come out after having been, for instance, found having public sex, or liked public sex, right? I think what's interesting is that, as you might know, sometime last week, Howard Kurtz got into a lot of trouble because he mistakenly wrote that Jason Collins had not mentioned his earlier engagement to a woman. And so a lot of fuss was made about that, and a lot of Kurtz's colleagues in the journalism world began to criticize him. And they said, well, how could you say that? Of course he was out about it. And what is fascinating to me about all of that is there was all this talk then about authenticity and about realness and about what it means to be really authentic and live, you know. And I think Collins has also used these sorts of terms, you know, to be authentic and to be true to who I am. And I have to ask, well, can you not be true to who you are if you are married to a woman as a man? Can you not be gay? In other words, I think what is also fascinating to me, coming from the work I do, is it's obvious to me that no one will let you come out as queer. And that the very same straight people who are now praising Jason Collins and being very angry, Howard Kurtz has since lost his gig over at the Daily Beast, which is a big deal. That's a big gig to have. He claims, of course, that it has nothing. The two things are not connected, but I think most people are making those connections. Howard Kurtz has had to pay the price for daring to claim that Collins might be inauthentic, and I actually find it rather troubling that people are so bent upon Collins being a very perfect, very gay player rather than a messier queer gay.
And this is an incredible burden to have on any one person, as that would be perhaps one of the comparisons to make to Jackie Robinson, someone who had to hold it together and be upstanding and ideal through an enormous amount of adversity. From HRC, actually, from their website, folks are thanking him for his monumental step forward towards greater equality. And he immediately becomes a role model for youth all across the country. I mean, that's huge. That's a lot to take on for any one individual. In fact, he cannot be the Superman as an antidote to what are really structural and social problems. So as for the movement, you know, you mentioned his statement, and we have about maybe 2 to 3 minutes here. In his statement, it really is a reflection of this political climate we are in for gay politics and organizing. And his statement really projects the values and beliefs of that equality movement. It also reflects the requirement, as we have said, for heroes to be exceptional. So what is it that gets erased? And we've talked about this so much in this process, because what we obviously need is a broad-based political movement that accounts for all the concerns and issues that gay people have. And we have just about a couple minutes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so you're asking what accounts for this kind of...
Well, I think just in the question of when the dominant narrative is always this story of equality and and upstanding citizens, where do we move in order to kind of build this more imaginative queer left that addresses the issues of all those folks that don't fit into that paradigm?
Right. I think that's why it's necessary for the queer left to constantly ask questions, and instead of simply... I think even what saddens me is when even members of the queer left decide to play up the whole "isn't it wonderful that he's coming out as gay" narrative. And I think there's also, I think, a way in which different ways in which we can challenge, right, the heteronormative kind of paradigms. So I think one way, for instance, is in Quebec recently, some anonymous queers took on the massive anti-homophobia campaign that came about in March, which was, you know, in many ways reflective of the kind of narrative that Collins is putting out, right? You know, the perfect couple, the undangerous couple, undangerous, if you'll forgive my using a word, inventing a word, but, you know, the couple holding hands, the relationship that lasts for 30 years and so on. So recently what some anonymous queers, I have no idea who they might be, did was to launch a counter series, a counter campaign showing queers, for instance, having wild sex, showing queers talking about anarchy, war, and so on. And I think those are the ways in which we have to resist that kind of heteronormativizing, as it were. And which is also, and it's not just about sex, right? It's also about pointing out to people on the straight left that asking gay people to live up to such requirements is actually being uncritical of the larger kind of economic paradigms into which all these notions of bourgeois respectability are tied. I think that economic critique is also fundamentally important. So it's not just that we talk against these normative paradigms in terms of, look what fabulous sex we have, but to say these paradigms are part of a neoliberal privatization, right? Are part of a requirement that gays also become and stay part of capitalism.
Right. Well said. And we'll finish with that. I've been talking with Yasmin Nair, who is a Chicago-based writer and activist. We've been discussing the recent coming out of Jason Collins. And Yasmin, I mean, perhaps you'll end up being a sports fan after all of this. I know that you will be.
I have to keep my eye out on it.
Yes, and I love that you pulled out the Glenn Burke reference. That was quite savvy. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, as always, Denise. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm up. This is KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. Thanks, Denise. After a short clip from Mark Dworkin and Melissa Young's movie Shift Change, Movie Mole's Fran Michel and Joe Clement will review the film. Again, it's playing tomorrow at the Red and Black.
I work here as an employee, but I also own one share of the company. I have a say in what happens with the company, which is awesome.
We have a stake. We have skin in the game, as they say.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement, and I'm joined by Fran Michel. We're here to review the movie Shift Change. Shift Change is a 2012 documentary about the cooperative business movement. Produced and directed by Mark Dworkin and Melissa Young, it features workers, managers, and financiers who work in or with co-ops. They go over the world, such as to Spain's Mondragon, but focus on cooperatives in the United States, including Ohio Solar Cooperative, Women's Action to Gain Economic Security or Wages, and Equal Exchange, which has offices and a warehouse here in Portland. The film will be showing for free tomorrow night at another worker-owned cooperative called the Red and Black Cafe on Southeast Oak and 12th. It'll be for free and start playing at 7. It's only a 70-minute film, so we are hoping to have a discussion afterwards. Well, Fran, I first found out about this film at the Hollywood Theater last year. I went and saw it with some fellow workers, and we thought that it was interesting but problematic. It really tugs at middle-class anxieties about capital flight and the decimation of job markets. And I thought that would be a good place to start because it really is what's going on throughout this film.
And it's also where the film starts. It opens with shots of Cleveland, Ohio, and the boarded-up houses, decaying factories, people talking about the capital flight, about the foreclosure crisis, about the closing of factories, and talking about the loss of a middle-class way of life that people had hoped for, counted on, once believed in. And then it switches to say that despite this economic crisis, this problem is not happening everywhere. And we get beautiful shots of the lush green mountains of Spain, and we start to learn about the Mondragon cooperatives, an early example of the cooperative movement that began in the 1950s and has spread now all over the world. It's one of the most successful instances of cooperative business in the sense of it's still in existence. We're on the third generation of Mondragon workers and participants and worker owners. There are also, of course, employees in Mondragon companies now. But the film is fairly conventional or standard in its documentary style. We get some voice of God narration voiceover narration. We get talking heads, archival footage. There's nothing too outrageous about the style of the presentation. And I think that sort of fits with the appealing to people whose expectations are fairly conventional, to invite viewers to think outside the box in this time of economic crisis, to think about other ways in which work can be organized, businesses can be run. And so I think insofar as it's pointing out to people that there are cooperatives, they often are successful, they are certainly on the whole doing better than conventionally organized businesses in this time of economic crisis, that it's bringing the idea of cooperatives perhaps to people who weren't familiar with them.
Right. On the back of the box that the DVD comes in, it says, at a time when many are disillusioned with big banks, big business, and growing inequality in the United States, employee ownership offers real solutions for workers and communities. And this is one of the kind of recurring themes of the movie, is that ownership is what really gives people power. And it's interesting that the box speaks about big business when Mondragon seems to be a very, very big business.
Yes. And it's also interesting, as you say, solutions for communities. Another thing that the film stresses very much is the importance of the local, that these organizations are a kind of protection against capital flight or job outsourcing or offshoring, because you're not going to move your own job out of the country. And they root themselves in communities by tying to anchor institutions like hospitals, like universities, businesses that are not going to be going anywhere soon. So there is a kind of rootedness in the local that's really important to the cooperative movement. On the other hand, Mondragon, as you're pointing out, has gotten so big at this point that they now have branches, they have opened factories in China. Those are not worker cooperatives. They have employees there. And so they are being pushed into operating more and more in the ways of conventional capitalist businesses.
On the film's website, shiftchange.org, it mentions in the title bar, putting democracy to work. And what you really see in this film is something more along the lines, perhaps, of economic democracy than workplace democracy. But really, the film stresses something more like industrial democracy, where we see egalitarian principles operating on the level of industry or of nations, or really these networks of cooperatives. And while at one point one worker talks about how they have consensus decision-making on the level of their business, how that actually plays out in particular decisions that might be offered as examples isn't really clear.
One of the interviewees from the Mondragon companies talks about, well, several of them talk about the ideals of cooperatives and working in a cooperative being something that will make people learn to become more free, more self-organized at every level, less willing to be pushed around, less willing to be pushed around by bosses, by the police, by anyone. And so there is a kind of ideal of creating autonomous independent and assertive citizens, workers, participants in their communities that somehow comes out of this position of being in a cooperative company, in a cooperative business. It's not always clear how that happens precisely. We learn that there is a training process, there's an orientation process for workers to choose to become involved. We know from things that some of the people in the film say that there are a lot of meetings involved. You spend a lot of time in meetings, at least at some of these cooperatives. But we don't get a sense of, for instance, how conflicts are resolved or how the day-to-day workings in a lot of these companies necessarily happens. It seems as though the different companies have somewhat different models, and it's not always clear how each one is operating. And so that is a little bit puzzling and a little bit complicated in figuring out what's going on in the film.
I do like that most of the the people who appear in this film are workers themselves. And one thing that keeps coming up with a lot of them is that it is very different from other jobs that they've had, that they do feel more respected. They feel less pressure from the arbitrary whims of tyrannical management.
One of the things that some of the ancillary material around the film refers to is the importance of dignity at work, and that cooperatives offer workers dignity and respect, and as well as empowerment. It also comes up in the film that there's a notion that this will lead to larger social changes, that their goals are not just to be successful as a business, not just to change business practices, but to change a society, to empower people more broadly, to create other kinds of institutions, not just businesses, but schools and hospitals and healthcare, and to really change the whole structure of society. That's not something that, in fact, we are aware of having necessarily happened. And some people have criticized the cooperative movement, or those who tout the benefits of the cooperative movement, for being a little bit Pollyanna-ish insofar as these cooperatives are still operating within a capitalist economic system, and they're still subject to those kinds of pressures. And David Harvey, for instance, who is not profiled in the film, has talked about the ways that the capitalist law of value can lead to cooperatives engaging in self-exploitation, that workers can be pressured to become their own exploiters in the course of this.
And this is spoken to when you hear numerous workers talking about how in the good times they will reap the benefits, but in the bad times they, you know, accept pay cuts and things like that. And it's not very clear whether this is acceptable to them because they're already paid so well that they can deal with those fluctuations, or if they are starting to rationalize their own self-exploitation.
There's also some concern in the course of the film about, if from the people at Mondragon, about the next generation. There's a lot of concern in the interviews at Mondragon about the transmission, the generational transmission of these principles, and the fear that they are losing the collective spirit as the companies have become larger, as the cooperative networks have become larger, that people are, they talk about the younger generation is less willing to give up their leisure and their free time.
I think that we need to juxtapose this with what one woman who works for Mondragon University says, where she thinks that the cooperative spirit's being lost, but because people are becoming more inculcated in a business culture. And it, you know, really raises the question of how are co-ops really socializing us?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about democracy at work, and people in the film certainly talk about being happier in their jobs at their co-ops than they were in any conventional jobs, that they have more autonomy, that they have more control. But a lot of it seems like the version of democracy in many cases seems to consist of voting. They vote in the board, or they vote in the managers, they vote on particular things, but they don't necessarily have day-to-day control. And there is a more equal kind of structure, but it's not completely equal. So one of the interviewees mentions that the managers make 3 to 5 times what the workers make. Well, that's 100 times better than the difference between workers and managers in conventional businesses, where the CEOs might make 200 or 300 or 400 times what the worker makes, but it's still, there's still an inequity there. There's still an inequality. There's still a big hierarchy that's shaped by these structures. So it's not entirely clear. There are certainly ranges of or degrees of autonomy and control that workers have. They're not all being run by consensus, clearly.
But I think that's really what makes this film so interesting, is that it is very candid about these contradictions. And that may not actually be the prerogative of the filmmakers was, but it is the reason that I think people should come and watch this and have a discussion about what isn't being said in the film. One of the reasons we're showing it to the Red and Black is because they are a very different kind of worker-owned and collectively managed and actually unionized cooperative.
A lot of the co-ops profiled in the film have come out of worker struggles, have come out of strikes. For instance, Union Cab in Wisconsin, there had been a strike. The owners decided they were just going to shut the business, and the drivers and dispatchers said, we know how to run this. We're going to take it over. So sometimes there's a kind of move from the union spirit to controlling the whole business, that workers are empowered by their unions to become owners, although this film focuses primarily on the ownership aspect. There are hints in the film of connections between those aspects of work.
Right. The idea being that if you're an owner, you have a stake in the company and you're not going to blow off your work. You're going to take it seriously. We kind of hear this sometimes in the comparison between people who own their homes and people who rent their homes. And it's, you know, a kind of weird idea because it's looking down upon a certain class of people.
And there is a way in which the film doesn't acknowledge the economic limits of cooperatives, for instance, that if they sell you a cup of coffee that has been fairly traded and picked by a farmer's cooperative, that that cup of coffee is going to cost more than a cup of coffee you get someplace else. And that means maybe not everybody is going to be able to buy their coffee there.
But as one woman says, that just is the cost of doing this kind of business. That's all the time we really have to discuss this today. If you come to the Red and Black tomorrow, Tuesday evening at 7 p.m., there will be a discussion about the co-op movie and the co-op movement with hopefully members of other co-ops in the Portland area. Equal Exchange, as I already mentioned, is going to have people there. The Red and Black is going to have its co-op members there. Maybe Alberta Street Co-op, People's Co-op. For The Old Mole, this has been Joe Clement and Fran Michelle talking about Shift Change.
Great insights, Fran and Joe. I look forward to seeing the film. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Next, Bill Resnick speaks with Barbara Miner.
Hi, Barbara Miner.
Hello, Bill.
Barbara Miner is the managing editor of the journal Rethinking Schools. She also writes she'll be in Portland this coming Friday to talk about her recently published book, Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. That city is Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where, incidentally, I attended high school and got my degree with minor honors. But we are not going to discuss those prehistoric days. Instead, we want to go to present Milwaukee, which has pioneered voucher programs and charter schools and the attack on public education. Barbara Miner, tell us about the current state of Milwaukee schools, how the vouchers and privatization came to happen, and assess those experiments.
Well, thank you, Bill, for that introduction. It's interesting because I've been traveling around the country speaking to people, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Seattle. And, you know, when I tell people I'm from Milwaukee, I sometimes notice a vague look in their eye, like, Milwaukee, where's that, Minnesota? And they might try and remember something, you know, beer, brats, and reruns of Happy Days and the Fonz. And if they follow education, you know, I'll hear them kind of go, oh, don't you have that school choice movement, those vouchers? And some might even say, and all those horrible failing schools. And, you know, and I hear that, and I cringe. I cringe because I refuse to use the term school choice. And I refuse to use the term failing schools because even though the power brokers try to define Milwaukee by choice and failing schools, you know, my response is, what we have in Milwaukee is abandonment, hyper-segregation, disenfranchisement, and very privatized consumer-based solutions to complex social problems. You know, so in this respect, Milwaukee, yes, it's an iconic city in America's heartland, but in this respect, it's also really everywhere USA.
And what is the role of schools in the disinvestment and displacement and abdication of responsibility for all children while parents search for privileges for their own or semi-privileges or relative privilege?
Right. Now, in Milwaukee, basically what happened is 20 years ago, you know, Milwaukee power brokers decided they'd rather abandon the public schools than fix them. Now, we all know public schools, especially in urban areas, need to drastically improve. But in 1990, rather than put money and energy into the improving of the public schools, we became the first city in the country with a voucher program. Now, it sounds sort of nice, a voucher program, but what it really means is that public tax dollars are taken out of public schools and used to pay the tuition at private schools. Just as in the 1960s, the term states' rights was code for opposing federal civil rights legislation, it's clear that today choice has become code. And in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and increasingly across the country, the term school choice is code for initiatives that funnel public tax dollars into private voucher schools or privately run charters. And it's code for reforms that quite unabashedly abandon democratic principles and look to the marketplace and individual decisions by consumers. So I think it's important. You know, choice, it's very powerful and seductive rhetoric, but we also have to look at the context in which it is being used today in 2013.
Does that mean in many areas of the city the kids are going to defunded schools and some privileged kids are permitted to enroll somewhere else? And, in fact, the Catholic schools and the private schools are, in fact, doing much better. Is that the way it works out at Milwaukee?
Well, there's no one easy answer because Milwaukee really has what I sometimes call sort of marketplace chaos in terms of all the different choices out there. But in terms of the voucher schools, I mean, it started as an experiment, but even then ideological backers and the big funders, they had a strategic goal of universal vouchers. And bit by bit, the program has expanded. So right now, there's almost 25,000 students receiving vouchers. And the catch is that even if every single student in a school is receiving a voucher school still gets to define itself as private. Most significantly, about 85% of the students receiving vouchers go to religious schools. So above all, it has truly become a way for public tax dollars to fund religious-based education.
I know that there was a big case in Cleveland some time ago. I gather that this is found to have been legitimate by the Supreme Court.
It's interesting, the rationale that was used to what I would literally say sneak funding of religious schools passed the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was a 5-4 decision, like many, difficult and heartbreaking decisions, 5-4. And it was fascinating because the argument that the pro-voucher people used, because clearly when you have tens of millions of dollars every year going to religious schools, public tax dollars, on its face it seems like government support of religion, which is, opposes the freedom and, separation of church and state. But what the voucher supporters argued very cleverly was that the money was actually going to parents, not to the schools, even though the money was sent to the school in the parents' name, and the parents had to immediately co-sign that check over to the schools. But it was enough of a ruse that some of the Supreme Court justices said, well, the money is going to parents, and the parents are making the decision, not the government. And it was a quite disturbing decision by the Supreme Court because my concern is that that same logic can be used for privately run charters and all sorts of the different for-profit and charter schools that are cropping up around the country. And this can quite easily be a way to completely undermine any collective democratic control and responsibility for education in this country.
It seems to me it's the way in which the school systems will become extremely class segregated. That is, the basic voucher grant will buy a truly miserable, ill-cared-for school with little of the kinds of comforts and programs and facilities and materials that make them libraries, gyms, and the rest that are part of making school a pleasure, as well as smaller class sizes. These schools that are getting vouchers are also sometimes asking parents to pay another $2,000 or $4,000 or, in fact, in some cases, $20,000 to enter
there. Well, you raise an interesting point because for many years, the voucher was to be accepted as full tuition to try and counter that problem of richer people being able to add to the voucher. However, in the last budget cycle, the Republican governor and Republican-controlled state legislature put through a measure that for voucher families at the higher end, above 220% of the poverty level, the high schools can now charge that additional tuition, and the high school gets to set the amount. So we have seen in Milwaukee how what was billed as a small program to help poor black kids is bit by bit, year by year, really marching towards that universal voucher agenda that, the economist Milton Friedman laid out way back in 1955. And under Friedman's vision, I mean, it was clearly, Friedman said, He made no bones about it. We need to replace our system of public education. And his system would be vouchers. And everyone would get vouchers, and they could go to any school, public, private, religious, secular. And this is the best part. He said the oversight would be minimal, you know, on par with health inspection at restaurants. Or as I say, make sure there aren't rats in the kitchen, but who cares if food is any good. So anyhow, and you know, in Friedman's view, everyone would get vouchers, but the vouchers would be mere subsidies. And more affluent parents could add to that voucher and pay the tuition at expensive private schools. And we see how in Wisconsin, as I said, bit by bit, year by year, the voucher advocates and supporters are increasingly expanding the program till they reach Milton Friedman's vision. And I think it's really the responsibility, and luckily in Wisconsin, people are beginning to wake up to the voucher realities. And Scott Walker, our governor, wants to expand vouchers across the state, and there are cities across the state that are saying, we don't want this. You know, we've seen what vouchers have done to undermine the Milwaukee public schools, and we don't want that in our city. We want money for our public schools.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Barbara Miner. She's touring the country, talking about her recently published book, Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. The city is Milwaukee. We've been talking about the development of voucher and privatization schemes in the city of Milwaukee. We discussed how vouchers now in Wisconsin are being used to supplement the costs that private schools are now charging. You know, Barbara, in thinking about vouchers, I've been convinced that the line, if you like the way the American nursing home system and the American child daycare system works, you'll love voucher schemes for schools, namely the rich get wonderful programs because they pay a lot of money, and then we'll get, of course, a little voucher. The middle classes can scrape together enough money plus the voucher to get something that's decent, or at least the upper parts of the middle class. And at the bottom end, the basic voucher payment is going to be very small, and kids are going to be going to terrible places, often with people who, in fact, pay themselves very large sum to manage very low-paid staff that come and go, and where the kids are warehoused at best. That's the system now that's developing in Milwaukee? Is that?
You know, it's interesting because there's a wide range of voucher schools. In Milwaukee, we've had a long-standing Catholic school system, Lutheran school system, and they've got, you know, good reputation. But because the schools are defined as private and accountability and oversight is very minimal, we've had just a rash of what people, you know, sort of mom-and-pop fly-by-night schools that are, quite frankly, just horrific. And so what we have is, you know, for 20 years, people said vouchers are the silver bullet, they're the answer. You know, give parents choice, and the marketplace will work its wonder, and education will improve. Well, for 20 years, this has derailed broader and more necessary discussions about how to improve public education. Since 2010, and that was the first year in which the voucher schools had to publicly release test scores on state standardized tests in math and reading. And the voucher schools performed about the same as reading as the public schools, but significantly worse in math. And when special education students were factored in, the voucher schools performed significantly worse in both reading and math than the public schools. And people said, wait a minute, you've told us for the last 20 years that vouchers were going to fix our education problems. And here we are 20 years later, and they're worse. And so there's been this false promise. And yet, so what has been Governor Walker's response in Wisconsin? He wants to expand vouchers across the state. I mean, it's crazy. It's like this Alice in Wonderland world we live in, where reality and government policy by the Republicans seem to have little to do with each other.
You know, that's an interesting thing to talk about. My sense is that, in fact, the assessments of voucher systems find that same pattern across the country. Some of them are good. Many, many, many of them are bad, and in fact, even on these crummy tests, these terrible tests, which in fact many voucher schools are direct, you know, have concentrated on and teaching to those tests, often by rote means, their kids do worse. It's, how do you explain that?
In Milwaukee, as in every urban area, there's been this tendency to look at education in complete isolation from other social realities. You know, whether it's jobs, segregated housing, health care. Now, for example, in Milwaukee, you know, we are a city where 50% of the African-American men of working age do not have a job, where the infant mortality rate in the African-American community rivals that of the Gaza Strip, and where the incarceration rate of African-Americans is the absolute worst in the country. And our segregation is so bad that we've had to coin a new term to describe the intense segregation in the Milwaukee region, and it's called hypersegregation. So here we have a city with hypersegregation, massive joblessness, infant mortality, incarceration, and the powers that be, what do? They say they blame the schools. You know, and I agree the schools need to improve. That's not a question. But what they're doing is they're ignoring these huge, huge, incredible factors of jobs, housing, incarceration, health, and saying, oh, yeah, let's fix our schools and everything will be okay.
And they can fix the schools not by, in fact, creating schools that are sufficiently funded, but they fix the schools by this sort of whatever choice business.
Right, and it's also important, you know, in Milwaukee, when I mention this around the country, people don't believe me because it's so crazy, but in Milwaukee, because the voucher is a state-mandated program, and the money comes from state tax dollars, but literally they take money directly out of the public school's budget in order to help pay for the private voucher schools. So for every student that they are suddenly sending to a private school, money is directly coming out of the public schools. I mean, it's complete transfer of public dollars from public to private. But there's no attempt to even hide it anymore.
Yeah, but in those circumstances, how is it possible that the voucher schools or the charter schools, how is it possible that those schools on standardized tests don't do a whole lot better than the public schools? And also the private voucher and charter schools can kick kids out who they don't like, who may be maybe poorly performing, and have no duty whatsoever to accept troubled and kids who are having difficulty to learn. How is it possible that those schools on standardized tests don't do a whole lot better than the public schools who find themselves with all of these responsibilities for troubled kids?
Clear that the overriding factor of all schools in Milwaukee is the intense, intense poverty of many of the students. And across the country, you know, researchers have long recognized that, by and large, results on standardized tests correlate, not at cause, but correlate with socioeconomic status. So they have what, you know, they call the Volvo effect. You really want to find out who's going to do well on standardized tests? Drive around the neighborhood and see how many Volvos, BMWs, and Cadillacs are in the driveway. So it's not too surprising that the private schools are not doing any better because there are so many factors outside the school's control. Plus, you know, you also have the problem in the voucher schools of what, as I said, these fly-by-night mom-and-pop schools where, you know, the teachers don't have to have a teacher certification. It wasn't until 2005 that teachers at the voucher schools even had to have a high school diploma. And now they have to have a college degree, a bachelor's degree. But there's no requirement that they be, you know, skilled or have any experience in the classes that they're teaching. And they don't pay that much, and there's sort of a revolving door of teachers oftentimes. So there's a whole host of problems that, you know, it's clear by just sort of saying this mantra of choice and vouchers and privately run charters. You're not addressing the true problems. We no longer talk about what do we want our children to learn. Should children have art and music? Should children learn a second language? Should children have comprehensive science labs? You know, instead, everything sort of gets sidetracked into this, like, voucher, 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 charter, 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 choice, choice, choice. Like, no, wait a minute. Let's talk about what we want our next generation to learn.
For more of Barbara Miner in Portland, Oregon, she'll be here this coming Friday at 4 o'clock talking about her new book at the Westminster Presbyterian Church on 16th and Hancock Northeast. It's two blocks north of Broadway on Hancock. Barbara, one last thing. The alleged school crisis, actually the schools are one of the places where as bad as they are, as underfunded as they are, where kids in poor neighborhoods get one or several meals, and often the roof doesn't leak. And it's warm in the winter. They're the last place in some neighborhoods where there's any kind of public investment or any public services. But, Barbara, the schools, the alleged schools crisis, it seems to me, is used to conceal all of the elements of social and economic breakdown, the high unemployment, the incarceration, the disinvestment in neighborhoods, and, of course, the poverty. It's all blamed, in fact, on bad teachers, lazy teachers, unions that protect lazy teachers. They're not educating the kids for all the wonderful jobs that America is creating. What do you make of that discourse?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening, as I said, you know, when I was in Philadelphia, Washington, Chicago, and it's pretty clear that people see more clearly that inherent link between schools and community. And so when the officials announced that we're closing the neighborhood schools, you know, people said, well, wait a minute, you've already abandoned our community. The schools are about all that's left, and now you're taking away the school? And, you know, so people are beginning to understand that, you know, caring for our children, caring for the community, caring for schools, caring for democracy, that it really is part of a single vision. And we need to connect the dots, not just city by city of what's going on in education, but connect the dots between city and city, community and school, school and democracy. And that there's a broad agenda at work here of needing to protect the rights of the 99% from the ravages of the marketplace, whether it's schools or jobs or housing. You know, it's easy to get pretty discouraged these days, but I think, you know, as Paulo Freire says, conflict is the midwife of consciousness. And I do believe that people are beginning to, you know, make the connections that 5 years ago they may not have been making. I'm hopeful.
Barbara Miner, looking forward to you being here this Friday. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill, very, very much.
Right, so long.
That was Bill Resnick talking with Barbara Miner. Again, Rethinking Schools of Portland is sponsoring her appearance Friday, 4 o'clock, Westminster Presbyterian Church. Now we conclude with Ivan on Eve Ensler.
Good morning. Eve Ensler is the oft-heralded author, feminist, playwright, performer, activist, and artist, best known for her 1996 play, The Vagina Monologues. Since then, she has taken her celebrity to global activism, fighting for women and girls' rights and increasing awareness for the sexual violence and other abuses and oppression proliferated against women and girls around the world. She is the darling of well-known feminists such as Jane Fonda and Gloria Steinem, and has celebrity support from Glenn Close, Susan Sarandon, Meryl Streep, Whoopi Goldberg, and others. She is not, however, without criticism. In my piece today, I will read two posts by different women regarding Ensler and her work. The first post is found on the website Gender Across Borders, where Tariya Khalid shares her thoughts on Ensler and her recent book, I Am an Emotional Creature, The Secret Life of Girls Around the World. Khalid has this to say. A couple of days ago, I stumbled upon I Am an Emotional Creature, Eve Ensler's ode to teenage girls around the world. Ensler, of the Vagina Monologues fame, has crafted 36 short pieces and a new campaign around her latest fight for the livelihoods, the empowerment, and the hearts of teenage girls who will undoubtedly struggle while trying to navigate what it means to be a girl today. I auditioned for the Vagina Monologues while in college. I felt like I was a part of a strong community. But the more we rehearsed, the more we began to pick the monologues apart. I wanted to think that the show was great thing, a wonderful thing. But I began to resent the words I was memorizing. I know that the majority of Ensler's monologues are based off of interviews, but I could not help but feel they were so presumptuous and self-indulgent. I didn't truly understand how Ensler could imagine what it might be like to be a Bosnian woman during ethnic cleansing or a woman during the reign of the Taliban. How did Ensler imagine a vocabulary or a language for these experiences she hasn't had? Unfortunately, the same is true for I Am an Emotional Creature. There are multiple monologues about girls living in horrific situations around the world. There's a victim of sex trafficking in Bulgaria, a suicide bomber in Palestine, a girl who has experienced female genital cutting in Egypt, a girl working in a factory in China, and other stories. Ensler explains her ability to write these monologues by noting the following at the beginning of the book. These monologues are not interviews. Each monologue is a literary text, inspired by traveling the world, by witnessing events, by listening to real or imagined conversations. On occasion, a monologue was inspired by an article, an experience, a memory, a dream, a wish, an image, or a moment of grief or rage, end quote. I am not sure if this is enough to substantiate what Ensler is attempting. There simply isn't enough depth or complexity to these narratives. The monologue should challenge our perceptions of what we think teenage girls experience and how they experience them, not what we, quote, dream, wish, or imagine they experience. On the About page of the V-Girl website, it claims that the book is, quote, a celebration of the authentic voice inside every girl, end quote. But herein lies the issue. The narratives are almost wholly inauthentic. As an extension of this issue, I also wonder, why is she telling their stories? Why are women reciting what Eve Ensler has imagined for them when they can actually be speaking or writing their experiences themselves? We are all women, but we are all women differently. We are similar, but we are not the same, and we are capable of empathizing and helping one another to the best of our abilities without claiming or possessing each other. This next piece is by Lauren Chiefelk, an activist, political organizer, and co-founder of the Save Wyabi Project, an advocacy group that aims to bring awareness to the sexual and domestic violence against epidemic against Native American women, as well as develop community-based solutions for Native women in both tribal and urban areas. In an open letter to Eve Ensler, Lauren Chiefelk speaks of V-Day, which is Ensler's global activist movement designed to end violence against women and girls. Lauren Chiefelk had this to say. This all started because on Twitter, I addressed some issues that I had with V-Day, your organization, and the way it treated Indigenous women in Canada. I said that you are racist and dismissive of Indigenous people. You wrote to me that you were upset that I would suggest this, and not even 24 hours later, you were on the Joy Behar show, referring to your chemotherapy treatment as a, quote, shamanistic exercise. Your organization took a photo of Ashley Collingbull and used it to promote V-Day Canada and 1 Billion Rising without her consent. You wrote the word, quote, vanishing on the photo and implied that Indigenous women are disappearing and inherently suggested that we are in some type of dire need of your saving. You then said that Indigenous women were V-Day Canada's, quote, spotlight. V-Day completely ignored the fact that February 14th is an iconic day for Indigenous women in Canada, and marches, vigils, and rallies had already been happening for decades to honor the missing and murdered Indigenous women. You repeatedly, in your conversation, insisted that you had absolutely no idea that these events were already taking place. So then, what were you spotlighting? When women in Canada brought up these exact issues, V-Day responded to them by deleting the comment threads that were on Facebook. For a person and organization who works to end violence against women, this is certainly the opposite of that. Although I'm specifically addressing V-Day, this is not an isolated incident. This is something that Indigenous women constantly face. This erasure of identity and white colonial feminism is in fact a form of violence against us. The exploitation and cultural appropriation creates and excuses the violence done to us. When I told you that your white colonial feminism is hurting us, you started crying. Eve, you are not the victim here. This is also part of the pattern, which is the problem. Indigenous women are constantly trying to explain all of these issues and constantly met with, why are you attacking me? This is not being a good ally. Indigenous women in the United States and Canada have agency, self-determination, and are quite capable of telling their own stories, and have been doing so for thousands of years. We are aware of the violence we face. We expect not only our bodies, but our agency, work, and contributions to be respected. None of this is new. We do not need a white person to legitimize our history and existence. Eve, this is your organization. My hope is that you do some self-examination about what's happening here. You have to see this before you continue doing this work because this is epistemic and imperial violence. Your actions are assisting violence, not ending it. Sincerely, Lauren Chiefelk. I'd like to end with what Audre Lorde has to say. I think it sums it up well. Quote, what woman here is so enamored of her own oppression that she cannot see her heel print upon another woman's face? What woman's terms of oppression have become precious and necessary to her as a ticket into the fold of the righteous, away from the cold winds of self-scrutiny? End quote. If you wish to read these posts in their entirety, you can find links to them on our page, Old Mole Variety Hour, on Facebook. Thank you. This has been Ivan Hale.
Thanks, Ivan. That was absolutely spectacular. And thank to everyone for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Special thanks to today's Old Mole presenters and their guests. In a few moments, you can listen to Jamie Partridge report from the picket line at Columbia Grain. On Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks about rebuilding the food shed. At 11, catch David Naiman's Health Watch, and then this morning's programming concludes with Madness Radio, hosted by Will Hall. Finally, this program will be podcast on the KBOO website later today and can be accessed at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Again, thanks for listening. We hope that you'll return next Monday at the same time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear a report from the picket at Columbia Grain. The company locked out Portland longshore workers this past weekend. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was at the site yesterday and filed this report.
Jamie Partridge, KBOO News. I'm standing out here in front of the Columbia Grain Terminal on North Lombard, out at Terminal 5, Port of Portland, where the ILW Local 8 is locked out. We have about 10 picketers out here in front of the gate. The SCAB, or strike breaking outfit, called Gettier, has moved about 40 workers in to replace these longshoremen starting yesterday, and today is Sunday, the 5th of May. The strike-breaking outfit has, the Gettier has, four security guards standing at the gate. This is the second incident of longshore grain workers being locked out. The first was in Vancouver over a month ago when United Grain decided to lock out and use SCAB workers. The Grain Consortium, made up of grain companies, international corporations that have grain terminals in Seattle, Tacoma, Kalama, Portland, and Vancouver, has been negotiating with the Longshore Union. The ETT Corporation settled with the Longshore in Longview with a concessionary contract a couple years ago, and now the other grain operators are attempting to get concessions from the Longshore, and the workers voted down a contract offer by 90%, and now the company is locking out these workers in first in Vancouver, United Grain, and here at Columbia Grain at Terminal 5. This is the first time that non-ILWU, non-International Longshore and Warehouse Union workers have been unloading and loading grain from the boxcars and the barges onto the ships. Corn, wheat, soybeans, for the first time since 1934, the ILWU has been forced off the docks. So I'm out here on the picket line talking with
Latea Daly.
And Latea, why are you out here today?
Well, I'm a mother of two, and I live in the St. John's community, and I'm really concerned about the effect it will have. I know that a lot of longshoremen live in the St. John's area, and if they lose their jobs, I'm worried how that'll affect the local businesses in the area and our schools that they donate to. I think that since my tax monies pay for these ports and for these companies to work here, that we should get good jobs in return. And I see this company coming in with armed guards, taking jobs from workers so that the companies can bring in cheaper workers.
Those are supporters honking as they go by the picket line.
So they can bring in workers for cheaper without benefits and work them part-time, which means my tax money will have to pay for their health care. And right now, I know that longshoremen have good jobs, and I don't understand why our port is allowing this to happen, why our local government is allowing this to happen. It's pretty disgusting.
Well, this is the first time that non-ILW, non-union workers have unloaded and loaded grain at this terminal since 1934. It's been almost 80 years now. What's the significance of this?
Well, we have the longshoremen that have worked these terminals for generations. They have the experience. And if we can have a company from a different country hire another union busing company from out of state to come and bust these jobs, it's going to have a significance for other workers, because who wouldn't be next? I mean, if they can do this effectively to an organized union, they're going to be doing it to workers everywhere in this country. So really, we need to be asking ourselves whose job is going to be forcibly taken from them next.
So you want any parting words for our listeners, Latoya Daly?
Yeah, the community is I hope, upset about this, as I am, and that they'll get involved. Occupy St. John's meets at Anna Bananas every Wednesday night at 7, and we're working on this issue. So is Jay with Jay. We're hoping to get other communities and other groups involved so that we can build the community fight back for this and show the longshoremen they're not alone, because this really is our fight. These are our ports. We own them, and our communities are going to suffer if this goes down. So Occupy St. John's, Jay with Jay, they're great places for people to plug in if they want to help.
And how can people plug in with Occupy St. John's or Jobs with Justice?
We have a Facebook page, Occupy St. John's. We also have a WordPress site, OccupySt.John's@wordpress.com. Jay with Jay's got a website. It's jaywithjaypdx.com.
.org, sorry. Thank you very much, Latoya Daly, Occupy St. John's, and concerned community member out here on the picket line with the locked out members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Jamie Partridge, Cable News.
America's kill list. You've probably heard about it. Made in secret, no target off limits, including American citizens. Author and reporter Jeremy Scahill has been on the ground across the globe, uncovering the story of this change in U.S. policy. The award-winning author of Blackwater, Scahill is in town to talk about his remarkable new book, Dirty Wars.